Hello and welcome to Written in Uncertainty, an Elder Scrolls podcast sat firmly in the grey maybe of the series universe. My name is Arimithius, and today we're discussing a figure that is both towering in scope and very personal, infinitely variable and one that often follows a pattern, and it's one that we've all been. Today we're asking, why are all the Elder Scrolls protagonists prisoners? Before I begin, I'd just like to thank Professor Jimbles for his very kind review on iTunes. I'm really glad you appreciate the content that I'm putting out, and I'm sorry it's taken so long for me to see your review. I've only just managed to work out how you see various iTunes reviews in different territories, and as you're in Australia, it's taken me a while to find you, so thank you ever so much again, Professor Jimbles. And as usual, our usual disclaimer before we kick off, just to remind everyone that this is my own understanding of the ideas I'm talking about, and not necessarily the whole truth of the matter, although I'll do my best to bring in other viewpoints as we go through. And if you have any other ideas, I'd absolutely love to hear them. Please leave a comment on the blog post that accompanies this cast at writteninuncertainty.wordpress.com, or join the conversation at the Written in Uncertainty Discord server. Also note, for the blog posts, I'll be linking all the sources that I'm quoting in this podcast there, so if you want to check out where I'm getting my ideas from, please go through and read all the sources there, rather than just taking what I say at face value, come to your own conclusions. This is what the Elder Scrolls is all about, and this is what this particular topic is all about in particular. So, first of all, what is the prisoner and why is it even an issue? Ever since Arena, we've had the protagonists in the Elder Scrolls games being prisoners to various degrees. I think there's a few exceptions in the spin-offs, and you can kind of argue that the start in Daggerfall is not really a prisoner because they start off in a cave, but I think somewhere in the backgrounds that's slightly got a slightly more definite backstory to the prisoner in Daggerfall, and so that's someone who has been a prisoner in the past. But why is this particular thing important? This is because you have prisoners who become heroes, and heroes have a particularly important role within the cosmos and the metaphysics of the Elder Scrolls. There's a beautiful quote that I think started all this off in the Elder Scrolls 3. The game starts with the line, "Each event is preceded by prophecy, but without the hero, there is no event," which has an awful lot of implications for precisely what the hero is, what the hero does, and how they function with relation to the prophecy and, by extension, the games. The idea of the prisoner as a mythical figure, as an important type of character within the Elder Scrolls universe, has been touched on at some parts in the games and very explicitly in the Clockwork City storylines in the Elder Scrolls Online, which has solidified some of the ideas that fans have been bouncing around for a few years about what the prisoner is and how it works. I'd also like to extend my thanks to Icefire Warden, or Al-Hattur, depending on where and when you've known him, for his absolutely brilliant text, which is Anuvanasi, Heroes, Prisoners, and the Godhead with a Thousand Faces. He's collated the vast majority of stuff relating to the prisoner within the Elder Scrolls universe and what it means, how it fits together, and put it all into a 56-page document, as it turned out, and put forward a very convincing case about what the hero is and the hero's role within the Arabis. I'll be touching on some of his ideas as we go through this. I don't agree with him on all the particulars. I'll be linking the thread on Reddit where I put forth my opinion on his document. I won't make this particular cast a critique of that. First of all, I just wanted to kick off with what the prisoner is. On one level, it also started off as a game design choice. It makes the beginning of a game very, very easy to micromanage and set up tutorials. A prison is, by its nature, a closed environment, and so you've got no real artificial reason, if you like, for limiting what the player character can do if they're already in a prison, you've got all the constraint you need in terms of saying, well, you can only go this way, you can only do these things. And so it's very, very easy to run through a tutorial teaching someone, this is how you move, this is how you jump, this is how you pick things up, this is how you use the few items that you're able to pick up, because a prison is such a self-contained environment. It's also, since involved into something of a tradition within the Elder Scrolls, it's the way that the majority of games have introduced things intentionally, I think, since 2002 with the Elder Scrolls 3. But certainly there's been coincidences to go alongside that that have kind of hinted at that sort of a setup and the reason for that. If you think about the exception that we've got, the Daggerfall start, a cave is something that's very similar in terms of how restricted you are in comparison to the outside world. It's still, you can only really go one way, you will have a very few limited things that you can do, there's not generally going to be many people around in the wake of a shipwreck, that sort of thing. So it was done for entirely the same reasons. From a story writing perspective, it also means that there's no need for a backstory. You have an environment where someone is entirely cut off from anything. They are a totally blank slate that can then be expanded on as the players want. They can be used however the player sees fit without the game developer imposing their own views on what sort of a character the protagonist is going to be. That may be a weakness depending on your perspective on what a role-playing game is and how a video game protagonist should pan out. If you look at something like The Witcher, that's got a very, very definite protagonist and attitude, and how they see the world and how they should be played out is a feature of how those games go. Their own reactions are woven into the narrative in a way. But with The Elder Scrolls, it's always been make your own adventure, make your own person, and the ability to have a prisoner have a totally blank slate is something that serves the Elder Scrolls purpose very well. We also have the notion that the prisoner can become a hero. And if you look at the Zurinarctus quote that I started us off with, it's a capital H hero. It's that this is a hero who determines something. It's the sense of the hero makes the event. Without the hero, there is no event. It determines the ultimate outcome of that event and the event itself happening at all. It is a way of making something that's possible into the real. We have a quote from Sothisil in The Elder Scrolls Online saying that the prisoner wields great power, making reality of metaphor. That's absolutely what's going on here when we talk about the hero creating the event. He's making a possibility into a certainty, or at least something concrete. The idea of linking prisoners with certainty is something that we absolutely shouldn't be doing at this stage. I'm sorry I misspoke, but it was the easiest way to express that particular point. It's also worth noting here that part of the power of the prisoner, why you have prisoners that become heroes, is because you have prisoners as a thing without limit, without anything really constraining them, which seems paradoxical, but bear with me. You have a prisoner who starts with nothing, they have nothing to lose, and therefore they can do or be anything. If we think back to last week, we were talking about radical freedom and the existentialist notion that what's actually constraining you from jumping off a cliff or clubbing the person nearest to you with whatever you've got in your hand is just social convention and your own conscience. If you have a prisoner who is entirely divorced from any sort of social context, which all the characters in The Elder Scrolls are, then it's right down to their own sense of what they want to do, how they understand the world. They are self-creations in that sense. It's entirely down to what they want, and so they're not limited by anything around them. This is kind of similar to how Tyler Durden processes his philosophy in Fight Club, the idea of hitting bottom before you can rebuild yourself is very, very similar to this idea. It's the idea of you break yourself, you tear everything that matters away, and you find out what the core of you is, so to speak. And then you can start rebuilding, you can start constructing your reality, your understanding on the basis of that. To move on to exactly what the prisoner is, the prisoner is a thing that inherently understands imprisonment and limitation and sees beyond it. We have a very, very nice definition of a prisoner within The Elder Scrolls Online, again from Sothasil, who says, "The prisoner must apprehend two critical insights. First, they must face the reality of their imprisonment. They must see the determinative walls, the chains of causality that bind them to their course." And then after a little bit more, "The prisoner must see the door to their cell. They must gaze through the bars and perceive that which exists beyond causality, beyond time. Only then can they escape." Now that's going beyond even radical freedom, even beyond the, well, I could do what I like, but you can't quite do what you like within reality because you're still bound by the laws of physics and causality. There's been a somewhat interesting relation with causality in philosophy throughout philosophy's development. There's been debate about what exactly causality is. Is causality necessary? How do things link together in terms of an event chain? And some of the more modern philosophers, it starts off with David Hume in the 18th century, but has moved beyond that, most explicitly, I think, from what I can remember, with Charles Deleuze, who has essentially said that empiricism, that is the study of how events happen in the world, and what we base the scientific method on, incidentally, is the science of imagination. Because Deleuze is taking Hume's leap where you can't necessarily say that just because, say, billiard ball A hits billiard ball B, that billiard ball B will necessarily move. There may be other constraints that we're not aware of that may stop it. So we can't determine causality as a necessary thing. Deleuze moves beyond that and says that what we understand as causality is based on our own experience. Our lived experience before each event is determining how we understand everything fitting together, which leads him to call empiricism the science of imagination. He's saying that if you start looking at how things fit together, you have to imagine how events are going to turn out and how causality is going to unfold, because you don't know that it's necessarily going to be the case. And this kind of works if you think about how athletes and snooker players, just to pick another example, see things. They visualize how they see things are going to turn out and plan and make their reality out of that, which is kind of what's going on here with the prisoner. They are seeing or existing beyond time, beyond causality. They're saying, this is my situation. I refuse to accept it. I will change my situation because I have no connection to my context. I have no connection to the reality in which I find myself, so I can remake it into absolutely anything. So from this, we have the idea that the prisoner can be anything, can do anything in some senses. And where else have we heard that sort of language before? The ability to reshape reality, to define it as they wish. That's very, very similar to talking about Chim and the various links that there are to the tower that Chim has as its central realization. Michael Kirkbride made a post on what I presume was the Bethesda forums, but I don't entirely know, in 2010 or 2011, that talks about the way that the constellations, the thief and the tower, interact. The way that he talks is saying that the thief is another metaphorical absolute. In this case, he represents the taking of the tower, or, and sometimes more importantly, the taking of the tower's secret. And then he talks about how the tower's secret is how to permanently exist beyond duplexity, antithesis, or trouble. And it then goes a little further and talks about, "One that knows Chim observes the tower without fear, more so he resides within." Now, being within the tower is how a prisoner can in theory start if we're thinking about this on a metaphysical level. They are imprisoned in a place that is a tower. It is a strong thing to hold things that are worth locking away. And the thief, which is potentially the most common role of the protagonist within the Elder Scrolls, I'll talk about this a bit more in a second, is also linked to the tower and getting to the tower and taking the tower's secret, so to speak. And just to pick up on the main point here and the biggest implication of the lot, does that mean that the prisoner, and therefore every Elder Scrolls protagonist in the series, has Chim? I think you can certainly make that argument, because you can say that the prisoner must reside within the tower to start with, and will then go beyond. There's the similar breaking of chains, breaking of causality, going beyond limits, that is part of Chim, and particularly the Psijic Endeavour in my reading of that. But I don't really think so. As much as we have talk of the prisoner seeing beyond Mundus and thereby determining their own destiny because they're not connected to causality, the prisoner feels far too connected to Mundus for that to be something that I think is linked to the concept. It's possible that the prisoner is an indeterminate state, that being locked in the tower in a metaphysical sense and then realizing the stuff beyond the tower and then reaching beyond that to the realization that the tower is the self, which is the central realization of Chim, which I go into in a previous podcast. I'll be linking this in the show notes as well. But in order to reach that realization, you need to start from the tower, and then you start from the tower and make another kind of destiny if you become a hero. It's possible that the prisoner could achieve Chim, is in a better place to achieve Chim, but I'm not sure that we can say that every Elder Scrolls protagonist therefore has Chim. I know there are some that disagree with me on that one, and I entirely understand how you can come to that kind of conclusion, because the realizations are very, very similar. I kind of think of it in the sense of the difference between a Bodhisattva and a Buddha, if I can go there, that you can achieve the enlightenment that comes with understanding the universe, but the Bodhisattva puts it off. They say, right, I'm going to stay behind, going to be within the circle of reincarnation again, and teach others how to achieve enlightenment. Whereas I don't think there's any particular prescription for a Buddha to particularly stay behind, that as much as they probably won't seek out death, once they've died, they will then achieve nirvana and be removed from the cycle. Whereas the Bodhisattva explicitly says, I'm going to return, I'm going to remain within the material in order to achieve, or in order to help others achieve what they can. Which also, now I think about it, sounds very similar to why Lorcan failed at Chim, and his creation of the Mundus to allow others to transcend is pretty much the Bodhisattva role. I also think that the prisoner fits that particular archetype fairly well, because they can potentially see the tower that is the Arabis, is the eye, and say, well, no, this is just me and I'm going to do what I will, rather than reaching the full realization of Chim, that is, and I am the universe and can do anything. That being said, the prisoner still can, in theory, do anything. We have the idea of the hero creating the event, and that means that they decide how the event goes, which is kind of similar to the observer role within an enantiomorph. One of the biggest metaphors for how the enantiomorph works is the way that quantum superpositions are resolved with the role of the observer. The observer collapses the waveform and says that the superpositions are going to be one thing or another depending on their observation. And we also have in Sothisil's words, maybe as the word he craves above all else, that the prisoner is the maybe, is the uncertain element, because they can do anything. And that doing is really quite central to how I understand the prisoner working, and particularly the hero working. Prisoners become heroes, so I'm going to transition now into talking about how the hero works. The hero, to my mind, is a thing that does. It's not a thing that is. Certainly that's true within The Elder Scrolls 3 in Morrowind, but I think that's still potentially the case for an awful lot of other things as well. The hero of K'vatch is another big example of this archetype, because they're not chosen. The Elder Scrolls 5 Skyrim kind of breaks this for me a little, because they are the chosen one, and everyone's about, oh, you are the Dovahkiin, you will do this, that, and the other, or maybe you can do this, that, and the other. If I remember Arngeir's dialogue right, it talks about how the Dragonborn is separate from the Way of the Voice and is connected a bit more to Akatosh and has their own separate destiny, which is a way of saying you will not do something the way that we know it's done. It's still, what are you going to do? There's still that element of maybe about it. The core idea of this for me, for the hero, is that the hero is something that does. It's not something that is. And that potentially explains why each hero is always referred to as a title and not a name. Because it's not a person, it's a role. The Nereverin is the person who defeats Dagoth Ur and fulfills all the various prophecies. The Last Dragonborn is the one who is the Dragonborn who appears when you've got the Red Tower trembling and the various other prophecies coming true according to the Book of the Dragonborn. And so even when you have got pre-prescribed things happening, they're just things to be done, or they are people who will do certain things. You can then choose to do those things and then become the hero, which is then turning the maybe into the is, in that you could be this thing, you are that thing, because you are doing a particular series of things which something that's called the Nereverin, and something that's called the Last Dragonborn, something that's called a variety of things, the Eternal Champion and all the other titles, is then said to have done. We also have an interesting idea that's kind of come up when people try and work out whether the protagonists within the Elder Scrolls have an actual history. Now, I've seen this most commonly when people try and look at what the Last Dragonborn's meant to be when talking about their past within the Elder Scrolls V, and the options you get are fundamentally contradictory, because you can say that you never knew your parents, or you did, or why were you crossing the border at various points. There's questions in Dawnguard and in the Sidna Mine quest, I think, where you're asked, where did you come from, what were you doing? And you can give any of those answers. The game doesn't make you choose any particular one, because you can choose your own background. The prisoner can be anything. The Elder Scrolls 3 in Morrowind takes this a little further, in that you are openly accused of being a fake in the course of the main quest line. You are accused of being an Imperial plant and a spy, which you kind of are, but are you actually the Nereverin? You've been getting these visions from someone claiming to be Azura, and you can also say, when you're speaking to Dagoth Ur, you can say, well, why are you doing this? What are you going to do with the tools? All this, that, and the other. And you can give any answer of, I am Nerevar, I am no one, I am doing this for myself. And he doesn't question you on any of it. It doesn't say, well, no, you must be Nerevar because you are here before me with the tools and I feel it within you and you have moon and star and all that. It doesn't say, no, you're wrong at any of those points. You can be whatever, so long as you go through the motions of the quest, so long as you do the things that the Nereverin does, you are functionally the Nereverin. And the hero is that sort of an archetype. The hero is the creator of the event, and we don't really need to know that much more about them, which is also potentially a reason why they fade afterwards, although I will get to an interesting little notion that potentially turns all this on its head from the Elder Scrolls Online in a bit. First of all, I just wanted to talk about the hero as a scribe. One of the comments that Michael Kirkbride has made on the forums, talking about how he sees the hero functioning relative to the Elder Scrolls themselves and within what the Elder Scrolls are, we have this quote: "Until a prophecy is fulfilled, the true contents of an Elder Scroll are malleable, hazy, and uncertain. Only by the hero's action does it become true. The hero is literally the scribe of the next Elder Scroll, the one in which the prophecy has been fulfilled into a fixed point, negating its precursor." So you have the hero as the scribe of the Elder Scrolls. It's resolving the uncertainty that is an Elder Scroll into something definite, into something true. They are making reality into a particular way, and thereby writing an Elder Scroll and making it into those absolutely indelible historical records that they become once the events that they describe come to pass. And now back to that little thought I had on predestination and freedom and so on that the Elder Scrolls Online drops in with us. That's in the text Chaotic Creatia, the Azure Plasm, which has this interesting little nugget at the end of it. "Such are the facts. What follows is speculation, born of conversations with the Sojourner during his infrequent and unpredictable visits. His theory is that the Soul Shriven's bodies are flawed because they've lost the focusing principle of their Inuic souls, so their vestiges are imperfect patterns. I concurred that this was likely, and then proposed the theoretical possibility of a Soul Shriven who, despite having lost his or her soul, possessed some other intrinsic Inuic aspect. This, shall we say, paragon Soul Shriven would form an unflawed body in Cold Harbour that was a perfect duplicate of the body worn in Mundus. In fact, if this paragon bore a sufficiently high Inuic valence, upon contact with Padmaic Creatia, its body would form almost instantaneously. The Sojourner scoffed at my theory, but seemed taken with the idea nonetheless. He went on to speculate that if such a thing were possible, it would possibly occur in a situation where the Mundus was in existential jeopardy. In that case, the Heart of Nirn would spontaneously generate such paragon individuals as a way of defending itself from destruction in a manner analogous to the way the mortal body fights off infection." Now that little preamble is very, very like how the vestige is formed. I think the purpose of this text, or at least the conclusion that we can very easily draw from this text, is that the vestige is a paragon Soul Shriven, that they're intended to be that thing which saves Mundus from existential jeopardy. But the question that I'm wrestling with at this point is whether we can say that heroes as a whole are created in a similar way. And can you then throw together those different types of creation and say that this is the thing that will save Mundus from its existential jeopardy? Is this the nature of the hero because of the way it's put together? That kind of feels fundamentally against the freedom of the prisoner, but it also feels quite paradoxical as well, because the Soul Shriven starts out as nothing and becomes the vestige and the hero and so on and so forth. But were they meant to do that all along, or did they choose to do that? Was there something in particular that was guiding what they were doing in order to save them? I don't think that we can necessarily say that the prophet and all of those events would really suffice as guidance in this sense. That feels a little too convenient, particularly because it doesn't work out quite how the prophet wants in terms of getting a new emperor on the throne. There's no real way of connecting the prophet so much with this kind of immune system response that this text seems to imply. But it's certainly an interesting little aside in terms of what the prisoner is and represents. And as much as we've talked about choice and everything that entails and the ability to be anything, do anything, are we really able to do that? And if we go meta for a second, would you really do anything but complete the main quest of the game? Yes, you can run off and do all the subquests and not touch the main storylines within the Elder Scrolls games, but is there really enough there to say that the prisoner wasn't put into that specific place to not be the hero? You can take this to another level and say, well, there are mods that mean that you're not necessarily a prisoner when you start up in some cases, depending on what set of mods you're using for each particular game, but that's not quite the games as designed, in my view. The idea that you are this thing that's bound and constrained and then released to this fundamental freedom, and then you do what you were designed to do, what you were programmed to do. I'm not sure that that's quite the intent here, but if we can generalize the stuff that Chaotic Creation is talking about, I don't really see any other conclusion at this point. I don't know whether it is generalizable beyond the Vestige, but as the Vestige functions in the same way that other heroes do, then it's probably something that we can apply to the other heroes. There is one final point I'd like to put as a contrast to that idea that these prisoners are being spawned as Mundus' self-defense mechanism, and it goes back to the notion of the towers. We have, in pretty much every single Elder Scrolls game since Daggerfall, or the main series, the numbered series, seen the destruction or deactivation of a tower. Within Daggerfall, it was the Numidium. Within Mundus, there was the freeing of Lorcan's heart and the consequent probable deactivation of Red Mountain. And then in Oblivion, the destruction of the Amulet of Kings and the activation of White Gold Tower. Within The Elder Scrolls V, the Snow Tower lies sundered, kingless and bleeding. And so I don't know whether we're meant to take that as the tower being deactivated or not. If you want to hear my fuller thoughts on that, please go back and listen to the fuller episode on the towers and how I run through that. But given that we've got that full list of all of these towers potentially being deactivated by the actions of heroes, then are these things really the saviours of Mundus? Are they really agents of stability and survival? I'm not totally sure, because part of the function of the prisoner, as Sothisil says, is to look beyond the walls that comprise Mundus, to see beyond that, and to potentially go beyond that if we want to extend the idea of breaking out of prison to breaking out beyond Mundus. I know I said earlier that I didn't think that prisoners necessarily had chim, but if the drive of a prisoner is to move beyond Mundus, is to go beyond the walls of the prison, can we extend that to say that they are breaking the prison as well? That they are going through and deactivating the spikes of unassailable reality that are the towers in some sort of an effort maybe to return Mundus to a state of existence within Oblivion, to destroy Mundus entirely? I don't know, but it's another thought that could explain why the prisoners are doing what they're doing. You have a glimpse of the things beyond Mundus, and the prisoners then have that subconscious drive to go along with events to the extent that they will start to bring about the fall of Mundus, which is a little interesting in terms of what the prisoners are doing. If you're saving the world but at the same time destroying it, are you really saving the world? I don't know. I'm going to leave that with you. Thank you ever so much for taking the time to listen. This has turned a little bit more rambly than I first envisioned when I set this out, and I hope I've given you some food for thought. If you have any answers to the questions that I've been posing in this podcast, please let me know. I would absolutely love to hear your opinions on what the role of the prisoner is, whether there's any ultimate purpose to it, whatever thoughts you have about the role of the protagonists that we're all playing in the Elder Scrolls games. And one final reminder, if you like this podcast, please subscribe on your favourite podcatcher. I'm now on most of the ones out there. And if you fancy a chat, please join the discussion on the Written Uncertainty Discord. And next time, we are finally going to get around to talking about Mantling. I have mentioned it in several casts, and I can finally find a space to fit it in. At long last, we will be asking, what is Mantling, and how is Talos three people? Until then, this podcast remains a letter written in uncertainty. You've been listening to Written in Uncertainty, a podcast written and presented by Aramithius. The music for this podcast has been kindly provided by Jan Glembotsky. Check them out on SoundCloud under Songs from the Lost Land, and I'll see you next time.